This is The Guardian.
Wenn man Leute fragt, was macht einen Investor aus, bekommt man oft diese Antworten. Investoren sind reich. Sie tragen teure Anzüge und haben Designertaschen. Sie waren Einserschüler und sind Mathe-Genies. Interessant, aber das stimmt so nicht ganz. Man muss weder reich noch Experte sein, um zu investieren. Mit iShares ETFs kannst du in Hunderte und Tausende von Unternehmen mit nur einem einfachen Schritt investieren. Schon ab einem Euro. Finde iShares bei deinem Broker oder deiner Bank und fang noch heute an, mit ETFs zu sparen. Kapitalanlagerisiko. Marketinginformation.
The government promised to fix the NHS, but A&E departments at breaking point, services on their knees, and social care once again crying out for a solution shows just how far we've got to go.
I've worked in the NHS now for over 20 years. Our healthcare system was the envy of the world. I don't recognise the job anymore.
Keir Starmer has staked his reputation on reviving our health service after what he says were years of Tory mistreatment.
The last government left the NHS in a critical condition.
So, in the midst of this impossible winter, can he and his government actually make a start? I'm John Harris, and you're listening to Politics Week in the UK for The Guardian. We've seen awful reports over the last 2 weeks or so about the current state of affairs in the NHS and accident and emergency departments in particular. Numerous NHS trusts have declared critical incidents. There have been reports of hospitals hiring corridor care nurses to specifically deal with the overspill of patients when need is too high. An annual NHS crisis over winter, it has to be said, is nothing new, but this feels different. Dr. Denise Langhall works in a hospital in the northwest of England, and she's the emergency medicine lead for the British Medical Association's Consultants Committee. She joins us now. Hello, Denise.
Hi.
You work as an emergency medicine consultant, a doctor. Just tell me right now, what is it like doing that job on a daily basis?
So right now, the situation is extremely challenging. You've just alluded to the fact that it feels different, and it certainly does right now. So we've been struggling with what we call winter pressures for a number of years now, and it's been getting progressively worse year on year. But this year feels like nothing we've ever experienced before, just in terms of the sheer volume of patients that we're trying to look after at any one time. It's just become incredibly challenging.
So just give me an example of a day from the last few days and from the time you clocked on and when you clocked off, what happens?
So I'll start my shift in the morning and we'll get a handover from the night team. And historically, if you go back maybe 10 years, there would be maybe 30 or 40 patients in the emergency department overnight that had been receiving care and waiting to move to wards or having some treatments before they were discharged. Now we routinely start the day with well over 100 patients.
Wow.
And I work in a department with maybe around 50 cubicles. So that already tells you that we don't have space for everybody. We start every day now with multiple patients that have been there for hours and hours and sometimes days waiting for admission onto the wards. So they've been seen and they've had their treatment in the emergency department and they need to be admitted to hospital, but there's no space in the hospital. So they get stuck in the emergency department on a trolley. I think most of the public will have heard of the four-hour target that we used to meet, where anyone who booked into an A&E should be through the department and up onto a ward if they need admission within 4 hours. It would be rare for us to get a patient into a hospital bed within 24 hours.
Wow.
And in reality, it's actually often much longer than that. And that means that we arrive every day to the department full, every cubicle is full of a patient waiting for a bed, and we've got nowhere to put the new patients that are arriving. Which means they inevitably, in some hospitals, they will end up queuing on corridors, on trolleys. And in some hospitals that don't have that corridor space, they'll be stuck in ambulances, kept outside, queuing in ambulances. And that's routine. That's every day.
What do you feel like as a doctor sort of entering that melee every day?
Nobody goes into healthcare not caring about people. You know, people who work in our industry do the job because we care about people and we want to do the best we can. And it's really, it's soul destroying, really, when you're coming onto shift and you're seeing people distressed and suffering, in pain and unwell, that you just don't have the resources to give the best care that you can to them. We talk a lot in healthcare over the last few years about something called moral injury. And what that describes, it's the distress that healthcare workers feel when they essentially feel helpless in a situation where they are not able to do the jobs they want to do to the best of their ability, and they see people coming to harm under their watch, and it causes us harm as healthcare workers too. Unfortunately, for a lot of doctors, it starts to have very negative impacts on their mental well-being and their mental health.
Forgive me asking you something as brutal as this, but you presumably then watch people die unnecessarily.
Yes, I think that's true to say. So the Royal College of Emergency Medicine have done a lot of research on this and looked very carefully into the numbers, and their data is extraordinary. You know, hundreds of people dying a year, thousands, because of delays in the system. But what it's really difficult to know is exactly who, and being powerless, it really, to do anything about it. But you're in the position on shift sometimes where there are so many patients that you just don't have space for, that it's a constant sort of struggle, really, and a constant minute-by-minute decision-making process to decide which patient comes in next, who gets your next cubicle, who's the sickest. And it just feels like a big juggling act all the time.
When a hospital declares a so-called critical incident, in a sort of direct sense of having to sort of do what you do in the midst of that, what does that actually mean? Just one reads that all the time without quite knowing what it kind of denotes, I suppose.
So a critical incident is declared when the demand exceeds the capacity. That's pretty much true all the time at the moment. So most hospitals in the UK are running at 100% capacity or over 100% capacity all the time. But we have been dealing with that for such a long time now that it's almost like the goalposts have moved of what we're coping with. But a critical incident really is when you get to extraordinary levels of demand that you just have no chance of the capacity meeting at all. So, for example, a hospital might traditionally, over the last few years, be capable of caring for maybe 10 or 15 patients on a corridor. But we're seeing situations where those hospitals now might have 50 patients.
Wow.
Queuing on that corridor. Wow. And that would trigger a critical incident because it just becomes so dangerous. The staff are stretched too thin. There just isn't enough staff to look after everybody arriving on the corridors. And that either means that patients are not being watched, they're not being observed, which is really dangerous because, you know, on corridors, there's no call bells for the patients, there's no monitoring. Or it means that hospitals have no choice but to keep hold of the paramedics that have brought them
in. Yeah, yeah. And then that follows through. Then someone's fallen down the stairs then and is lying on the floor for 4 or 5 hours waiting for an ambulance somewhere.
Absolutely. And that's the hidden risk. You know, you don't know who's out there in the community.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's almost the most vivid part of the NHS crisis for the general public is if you have the misfortune to be in the midst of one of those. Corridor care, from what you're saying, therefore, is just a constant reality. There's all this noise about this as if it suddenly arrived because of these recruitment adverts. But the point is that that's just part of your everyday experience.
Corridor care has not gone away since the pandemic. So we used to talk about winter pressures. We still talk about winter pressures because we know things do get worse in the winter, but we don't get that respite in the summer anymore. So I think most emergency departments will have had patients on their corridors every month for the last 12 months. It's just that over the last month or so, it has become actually quite scary, the sheer volume of patients that we're now having to care for in non-clinical areas.
In the midst of all that, what's it like having to tell people that they're not going to get a bed for a very long time? How do they react?
On the whole, the public are very understanding of the situation, and they know that the staff that are there looking after them are doing their best. However, it's inevitable that for some patients there will be frustrations, and for some patients' family members that have come in, there are going to be frustrations and anger.
But fear, not just frustration, fear, right?
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
I mean, I'll be honest, I've had a couple of these experiences lately, and the level of worry that you've got anyway is inevitably heightened because you just think, well, what's going to happen here? And what happens if the person I'm looking after starts to worsen? You don't know.
Yeah, no, it is. And it's frightening for the patient as well. An emergency department isn't like a ward where the lights get turned off at night and you get to have a nice sleep, where you get hot meals because you're in a bed that has a table and a meal can be served to you. If you're on a trolley on a brightly lit corridor with constant footfall for 24, 48 hours, how do you get your sleep? What do you do about, you know, your meals? You're eating sandwiches and not much else. it's simple things like going to the toilet is really difficult for patients that are on corridors. Yeah. There's generally, most hospitals won't have showering facilities for that number of patients that are on a corridor area. The whole situation is really undignified and really unpleasant.
I was going to ask you why you do what you do, but I could put that question another way, I suppose, which is about whether you're seeing some of your colleagues either talking about or actually leaving the profession altogether or going abroad. Because, I mean, yeah. You know, obviously, thank God you do what you do, right? I don't think I'd last 5 minutes at the moment or in any event really doing what you do. But that leads then back to the why do you do it question. I mean, it's those two things together.
I would say my job is still a privilege. In emergency medicine, people generally come to us on often what is the worst day of their life. And I get to help make that better for them. As to the second part of the question, are people leaving? Oh God, absolutely. And in their droves, I have written more references for junior doctors to go to Australia or New Zealand in the last 2 years than I've written in my whole career.
If you were the health secretary or you had the health secretary's ear, what would you say would be the first things you try and do to tackle this horrible emergency immediately? What needs doing?
So, a hell of a lot needs doing. So I think the first thing I would say to the health secretary is we know the NHS can work because it used to work. You know, if you go back 12, 14, 15 years, our health service was absolutely outstanding. If you needed an operation, you'd get it within 16 weeks. If you came to an emergency department, you'd be through the department within 4 hours. We were brilliant. We can do it. We've done it before. But we've been systematically underfunded now for over a decade. And just the cuts after cuts after cuts to healthcare and to social care have left us in this position that we're now in.
That's really interesting. Because on the health secretary's part and politicians more widely, there is this idea that there is something structural about the NHS which needs to change, right? So in other words, the model doesn't work. Whereas you seem to be saying, well, actually, the NHS as currently constructed could work if these questions of resources were tackled and more money was put in. Is that the essential difference between you and the people in charge?
It probably is a different philosophy. You know, I am someone who works in the NHS and I've worked in the NHS now for over 20 years. I don't recognise the job anymore. It's not the same. It's completely different to what it was. I think there needs to be huge investment. And I think probably starting with social care. Social care is beyond broken. In every hospital in the UK at the moment, there are dozens or potentially hundreds of patients stuck on wards waiting to be discharged that cannot be discharged safely because they either need carers to help them at home or they perhaps need a nursing home placement. And those carers don't exist and those nursing home placements don't exist. If we could get these patients out of hospital, we would have the capacity for the new patients that are arriving and we wouldn't be as gridlocked as we are now. I think the second thing that needs to change is staffing. We are so under-resourced from a staffing point of view to deal with the volume of patients that we're dealing with in the NHS. We have a massive problem with retention of doctors and nurses. I don't think it's any secret that healthcare workers' pay, doctors' pay particularly, has been cut for 15 years in a row, to the point where doctors are looking at their salaries and they're comparing salaries with countries like Australia, New Zealand, Canada. And let's be honest, just down the road over in Ireland, the salaries double. And people, you know, doctors are looking at that. They're looking at the challenges in the NHS. They're looking at their work-life balance and then they're voting with their feet.
Rachel Reeves is just to Anne Keir Starmer and West Street and everybody else. Although, you know, the NHS has got 22 billion more, right? We know that from the Chancellor's last round of announcements. But essentially, you and I both know we live in a country where we're constantly told there's no money.
Yep.
So looking ahead, if so much of it does come down to resources and cash, let's be honest, the picture's pretty bleak, isn't it?
Well, it's a political choice how much money you spend on the NHS. And certainly, I think if you compare the UK to other like-for-like countries, I don't think our healthcare spending is excessive at all. We know that we have significantly less doctors per population compared to other OECD countries. If we want the health service to be brilliant, then we need the resources to run it properly. It's a political decision.
Okay. That's a very simple and straightforward note on which to finish. Thank you so much for talking to us, Denise.
No problem.
Right, let's pause here for a minute. When we come back, we will look at the government's plan to fix the NHS, in quote marks, and the question of what would happen if they can't.
Wie kann man Risiko im Leben reduzieren? Einen Helm tragen, fit bleiben und die Freunde meiden, die verrückte Ideen hatten. Und beim Investieren? Hier sollte man diversifizieren. Wenn du in einen iShares ETF investierst, kaufst du in einem Schritt einen Teil von Hunderten oder Tausenden von Unternehmen. So musst du dir keine Sorgen mehr machen. Du kannst dir stattdessen lieber Gedanken darüber machen, wer die Fotos von der wilden Nacht mit deinen Freunden gemacht hat. Finde iShares bei deinem Broker oder deiner Bank und fange noch heute an, mit ETFs zu sparen. Kapitalanlagerisiko. Marketinginformation.
Welcome back. We're now joined by The Guardian's political correspondent, Kieran Stacey. Hi, Kieran.
Hey, John.
Right, let's talk about the NHS and what the government intends to do about it. We've just heard from a doctor in the northwest of England about the pretty terrifying state of our hospitals. We all have read those stories recently, waiting hours of 90 hours in A&E in some places, the employment of a new tranche of so-called corridor nurses, etc., etc. Labour, supposedly, is the party of public services. We both know they promised to fix the NHS. That was their words when they came in. And the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, has been given a relatively munificent £22 billion extra from Rachel Reeves to really help solve this problem. And let's be honest, he's pretty much the only department being handed any extra cash at all. Let's talk, first of all, about the immediate NHS crisis. What, as you understand it, is the government doing about that?
Well, as you say in the budget, Rachel Reeves pretty much had one department in her mind, which was the health department. That was the one department that got a really significant slug of cash, £22.6 billion over 2 years. That's for the day-to-day running of the health service.
Right,
there's an extra
right.
£3 billion for capital spending, so it was kind of improving crumbling buildings. But a lot of that money is actually just going to solve the NHS recruitment problem. That's going to plug holes in staffing across the country, basically to up people's pay enough so that we can get more doctors, more nurses into hospitals, into surgeries. The NHS has kind of been running on a shoestring for so long that simply keeping up it required this amount of money. There'll be some improvement, the government says. There'll be, you know, more GP appointments and that kind of thing will be freed up by this cash. But a lot of it is just plugging the gaps that were there before.
The government uses very sobering rhetoric about all this. It talks about its last chance to save the NHS, which is kind of backed up by what you read, you know. So people's use of private healthcare seems to be skyrocketing. There is this sense that if the NHS carries on failing in the way that it is, it will just collapse and the political opportunity will open to someone, in many people's eyes anyway, to get rid of it. So the stakes are very high here, even in the government's own account, right?
Yeah.
Wes Streeting also talks about the worst crisis the NHS has ever experienced. What are his plans for reform longer term? I mean, we know that they've got this 10-year plan, right?
Yeah.
And there are three sort of elements of it,
yeah,
which are a bit platitudinous and vague, but point in the right direction.
Yeah.
Hospital to community.
Yeah.
So in other words, you minimise the numbers of people who are on wards.
Yeah.
Analog to digital.
Yeah.
This will dovetail slightly with Keir Starmer's AI stuff we heard earlier this week. You're laughing. I laugh at the mention of that as well, but I shouldn't really.
Take it very seriously.
I'm sure he means it every word.
Yep.
And sickness to prevention, which is what all governments in the last 20 years have been saying, right?
Yeah.
You need a healthier population.
Yeah.
And then what sort of underpins all this or runs through it is Wes Streeting's understanding of the NHS, which is that it's an old-fashioned 20th century hierarchical top-down institution where there are a lot of people within it who have the right ideas about how to improve it, but their voices are constantly stifled by this sort of old-fashioned bureaucratic structure.
Yeah, I mean, the diagnosis is
about huge controversy here, but I think I basically agree with that analysis myself.
Well, I mean, it's not very controversial. I mean, the diagnosis has been out there for a long time. The problem is that to fix those problems, it can be a politically controversial and B, can be expensive. So one of the things that has happened constantly, for example, is the health service has had to raid their capital budgets to pay for day-to-day spending. Now, you only get past that by spending quite a lot more money on day-to-day spending, which, to be fair, is what this government is doing. But that's an expensive thing to do. The other thing, you know, when you talk about shifting from hospital to community, well, that requires a couple of things. That requires, first of all, more funding for local government because they're the ones who run social care a lot of the time.
Well, we'll get into social care in a minute. You know, I'm not sure how you can talk about one without the other, but we'll come on to that. Keep going.
Exactly. And the other thing it might require at some stage is closing A&E wards. You know, if you want people to be treated in diagnostic community centers or wherever, and not the hospitals. That means taking resources at some stage away from those hospitals into the community. But the problem is, anytime you try and shut up hospital wards, or especially an A&E, the local community gets up in arms about it, but maybe not surprisingly, and whoever promises to save the A&E ward tends to win the next election, is why it's such, it's such a difficult thing to do. And then, you know, when you look at analog to digital, well, that involves more money as well. You know, we've had these failed attempts in the past at digitizing the NHS. Now we're told that AI is going to be the solution to that. That means getting in private companies that may or may not succeed and may or not be the companies that we want. Each of these steps sounds great, and we can all agree that that's roughly where we should be going. But there are downsides, and that's why they haven't really happened yet.
I mean, arguably the biggest downside of all, or the biggest difficulty politically, is where the NHS sits always in the national conversation. Nigel Lawson, the late former Tory Chancellor, famously or infamously said that the NHS was as close to being a national religion as England has, right? And I think that's probably true. And therefore, there's a lot of sort of, nostalgia and sentimentality and all that around the NHS, which means it's quite hard to have a rational political discussion about it. Because as soon as you start to talk about changing it, right, the idea is, oh, you're going to privatise it, you're going to privatise it. Now, I would argue that some of what Tony Blair's government did when they were in power did sort of point in that direction. And some people, including me, actually, were right to worry. What Wes Streeting's talking about isn't really like that, is it? It is different.
Well, no, it is to a certain extent, because one of the things he does talk about is bringing in the private sector to a much greater extent to run NHS services. So, of course, what Blair did, what he pioneered, was the NHS spending money on the private sector for them to provide those services.
But Streeting's thing is, correct me if I'm wrong, is kind of filling gaps rather than the idea that you end up with an NHS which is like an archipelago of contracted private providers.
Yeah, I certainly don't think he'd describe it in that way, but he hasn't actually set any limits. Like, how much of the NHS do you want to contract out? For how long? One of the things that the unions were pushing him on before the election is, maybe we say we use the private sector for 2 years, you know, while we get through this crisis period, and then we can bring services back in-house. But he wasn't willing to put any time limit on it. He hasn't really put much capacity limit on it either. So we don't really know.
Do you think, therefore, there's a private Streeting and a public Streeting, that he is therefore sort of outwardly being quite cautious and careful and measured about what, and vague, as you say, about what he does and doesn't want to do with the NHS, but behind the scenes, he might be the ardent Blairite of the left's imagining?
Well, I think, I mean, he may well be an ardent Blairite, but I think actually the issue here is he hasn't figured it all out.
Right.
But, you know, I know cabinet colleagues of his who are thinking, what on earth is going on? We thought he had a plan.
Right.
We thought he had something in his back pocket ready to roll out on day one.
That's the impression he wants to give us, right? Among the cabinet, he's always Mr. Sleeves Rolled Up.
Yeah.
You know, expression of hardened purpose.
Absolutely.
I'm now getting stuck in. That's his shtick, right? But the reality doesn't quite match up.
Well, it's just taking a long time to figure out what exactly this plan to transform the NHS is. And by the way, we've seen little bits. So, for example, Keir Starmer gave a speech on the NHS at the beginning of the year.
He did.
And his big announcements were more community diagnostic centres and more surgery hubs, both of which were promised by the previous government as well. This isn't some radical departure from what previous administrations wanted to do. This is kind of, well, we'll do more of the same. That's not to say they're bad ideas, but this is not revolutionary by any means.
Let's talk about social care, because as I said a moment ago, you can't really fix the NHS without first addressing social care. The two things are intertwined in very, very obvious ways. So one of the reasons we have an NHS crisis at the moment is there are lots and lots of people in hospital who shouldn't be, because there aren't enough spaces in social care settings for them to be transferred to. We hear endlessly from politicians about the need to integrate the two, but the government has just announced recently that it's convening an independent commission to look into all the issues that swirl around social care. And I don't think that's going to report until 2028.
Yeah, there are going to be interim findings, I think, in 2026.
Well, that doesn't make me feel any better. Here we are right now. This is a problem, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where I think some hoped that Keir Starmer would get into government and unveil this grand plan that I couldn't say this before the election because it was just far too controversial, but here we go. Here is the plan. But in fact, they did pretty much the opposite, because one of the first acts they did was to get rid of any plan on social care and then launch this commission, as you say, which isn't going to report for a few years. Now, the thing is, it doesn't really need a 3-year commission. We know what the solution is. There needs to be some way of funding some kind of either cap on social care or for it to be delivered by the state, because people are just having to pay too much money at the end of their lives to fund their own.
These are all
social
things
care.
We've heard serially in recent years, right? The need for a national care service has become a sort of political cliche, but so it's never materialized.
The only question then is, all right, well, where does the money come from? And obviously, Gordon Brown was talking about using inheritance tax to do that. Boris Johnson was talking about using national insurance, this health and social care levy.
Theresa May came a legendary cropper on this issue at the election.
I mean, it pretty much cost her her majority.
So you see, the thing that strikes me about this government, among many things, is it's risk averse, right?
Yeah.
And so this is not an issue it's going to want to grapple with in the immediate future, is it, for exactly that reason?
And if you can't do it now and you've got a majority
right. Yeah.
I just don't think, you know, it's one of those things that's... Yeah.
If you defer something in your first 6 months in power, this is not a good sign.
When you've won with a landslide, especially.
The other big question is a whole load of issues summed up in the phrase public health. We are an ill country, right? That's undeniably linked to a whole range of other issues like inequality, poverty, housing, et cetera, et cetera. The government is dedicating new money to fixing the NHS, but we all know what's happened this week, right? Starmer's talked about ruthless cuts to the public sector beyond protected departments. The NHS is one of those, right? But that still asks the question of whether a renewed burst of austerity, let's be honest, will then pile even more pressure on the NHS, because that's what happens. We all know that, right? Once local authorities start going bankrupt and once... various forms of early intervention start to fall away, right, out in the so-called community, then the NHS always picks it up, right? That's what happens. That's another problem here, isn't it? You can't have, oh, we'll fix the NHS, oh, ruthless spending cuts. You know, that doesn't equate to a coherent story.
I mean, you could say this is part of the problem with protecting the NHS in the first place, which is you end up spending money on the most expensive bit of healthcare, which is dealing with the problem once it's occurred and not trying to prevent it.
You're all sickness and no prevention, to use West Street and Zone terminology.
So for political reasons, they clearly feel they need to keep the protections around the health service. And, you know, obviously it does need more money. But at the same time, if all your money is going to that and none of it is going to, for example, social care, which we talked about, or prevention, then you're just going to end up costing yourself more money. And that is exactly the kind of thing that Labour promised to fix before they got into government. You mentioned austerity, Downing Street, very, very cross when people use that word. They say the cuts we're talking about are nowhere near on the scale. What we are talking about is cuts to unprotected departments of 1.3% a year after 2026, which definitely
if you take inflation into account, that's still pretty punishing.
That's in real terms. But yeah, people will feel that.
Now, everything we've just talked about has happened in the context of what my script has called very poetically Labour's crap January. They didn't get off to a good start here. The government would have liked to enter the new year on its own terms, right? And we all know what happened. They had attacks and criticism over their refusal to begin another inquiry into grooming gangs. And now we've got these serious concerns raised over the UK economy and the public finances. This week, the second minister resigned in as many months. That, of course, was Tulip Sadiq, the city minister, and unfortunately for the government, the minister for anti-corruption. Watching Keir Starmer on telly in recent days, I think he sort of has the look of someone who's under the cosh somewhat politically.
Doesn't he always?
That's true, isn't it? God knows what he looks like when he's enjoying himself. Wouldn't like to see him chewing a lemon, etc. Talk us through what happened with Tulip Sadiq. It's sort of mind-boggling, this story. Yeah. So her auntie was in charge of a pretty awful regime in Bangladesh.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then in the great swirl of stuff surrounding this story, among other things, have you seen that photograph of her and her auntie and Vladimir Putin?
In Moscow, yeah.
And then Tulip Sadiq says, well, she was in Moscow and just seized the opportunity, a rare opportunity to say hello to her auntie. And then she happened to have her picture taken with the strongman ruler of Russia. It happens to me all the time.
Yeah,
Kieran, I'm visiting my auntie. I don't know about you.
Yeah,
there's always a dictator
who loves bombing
me on my iPhone.
Who hasn't been on holiday to Moscow and accidentally stumbled into a photograph with Vladimir Putin? I mean, it happens.
And their auntie.
And your auntie. Look, I mean, that essentially encapsulates what has happened here with Tulip Sadiq, which is that she has had this political career in Britain pretending that her aunt is not the increasingly authoritarian ruler of Bangladesh. Also pretending that she doesn't really have anything politically to do with her, Tulip Sadiq, when questioned about her aunts, she has always said, well, we don't talk about politics, we only talk about
personal
and family stuff.
But she was centrally involved in the UK in making the case for her auntie's party.
She used to work for her aunt's party. She used to be their spokesperson in the UK. When she got elected in 2015, she thanked the Awami League supporters in the UK for helping her get elected. She shepherded her aunt around Parliament. She introduced him to people like John Bercow, who was the Speaker of the House of Commons at the time. She was pictured alongside her with Vladimir Putin and various other dignitaries. I mean, she is absolutely inextricably linked with the Bangladeshi government. Now, the thing is, her aunt in 2009, when she was first elected, you know, this wasn't really a problem because her aunt was seen as a reformer. She was feted by the international community, by leaders around the world. So this was, if anything, a strength. As time went on, the Awami League and Sheikh Hasina, Tulip Siddiq's aunt, became more and more authoritarian, started locking up their political opponents. Basically, her connection to her aunt went from being a political strength to being a political weakness pretty quickly. But Keir Starmer doesn't seem to have realised just quite how much of a political weakness they were until the last couple of weeks.
Their line on it is still a pretty awful, I think, in public, the government, in the sense that ministers were put out in the media round and they kept saying, she didn't break the ministerial code, she didn't break the ministerial code. This sort of halfway, well, she didn't do anything that wrong kind of line, which I just thought landed all wrong.
Well, and Keir Starmer, in his reply to Tulip Siddiq, when she submitted her resignation letter, says, you've been fantastic and the door remains open for you to return to government. I mean, that's fine, unless the Bangladeshi Anti-Corruption Commission is able to prove that she was involved in some of these corrupt deals.
Yeah, it's quite hostage to fortune, though.
Because if they do, I mean, that does look really seriously bad for the Prime Minister over here as well.
There's a word that political journalists use, and it's only political journalists who use it, and that word is beleaguered. It's a bit like music journalists always say people brandish guitars. I've never heard anyone say, look at him over there brandishing something, right? And equally, nobody says he's looking a bit beleaguered. But it is a word in the sort of media vernacular.
Well, it's a good word for Keir Starmer.
Right, this is the point, right? And once it attaches itself to a politician or a government, it's very hard to shake off, right? Yeah. You become the beleaguered Keir Starmer, right? Are we there, do you think?
I don't know. I mean, it's a sliding scale, isn't it, John? Because once you get past beleaguered, you get to embattled.
You do. And then another word everybody uses in everyday life.
Yeah. And then, you're basically on your way on your way out.
What's beyond that one? Beleaguered, embattled.
I think then you resign, don't you? Once you're no longer embattled, you're out.
Yeah, yeah. A swear word is what lies beyond those things, but let's not go there. He's dangerously close and he knows it, I think, doesn't he?
I think beleaguered is probably about the right word. It kind of gets you that feeling of dogs by political misfortune, but also political mistakes.
It's another good one. Dogged.
Dogged.
Dogged by political misfortune.
People get dogged by things, don't they, in real life? I think the thing is, he actually, from what I'm told, he and Labour ministers returned at the beginning of this year feeling quite chipper, actually. Having had a break, he, of course, went abroad. The first cabinet session, I'm told, was quite upbeat. And even then, when this stuff was breaking about the grooming gangs, I think people in Number 10 feel that they were able to use that to their advantage and, you know, get out there on the attack, you know, defend Jess Phillips in a major way, accuse their opponents of being politically opportunistic. And perfect for them that Elon Musk became the face of that campaign for an inquiry on grooming gangs, because they could turn it all back on Elon Musk, who is hated in this country largely. And so, you know, not everything has been bad. I think actually, out of all this stuff, the most worrying thing that's happened in the last few weeks is the rise in bond yields. And it may well go away. That may well drop. But if Labour essentially loses control on the economy, which is the main reason that they're there, if they then have to, you know, start making quite severe cuts, or maybe politically even worse, introducing more tax rises, if it's felt that Rachel Reeves is no longer the Iron Chancellor and has lost a grip, then I think then it starts. Well, that's when it goes from beleaguered to embattled for both of them.
Okay. Right, well, in about a fortnight, you can come back and we'll talk about that.
Great.
Cheer everyone up. Thank you very much, Kieran.
Cheers, John.
Thank you for listening. As ever, if you've enjoyed today's episode of Politics Weekly UK, please leave us a review and subscribe to Politics Weekly UK wherever you get your podcasts. While we've got Kieran here, Kieran, Pippa Carrera and all of Politics Weekly are nominated for the People's Choice Award at the In-House Political Podcast Awards, and you can vote for us. Please go to politicalpodcastawards.co.uk/thepeople'schoiceaward. With hyphens in between everything, to vote for us. We will obviously post the link in the show notes too. And if you want to hear more from Kieran about the Tulip Siddiq story, listen to our sister podcast, Today in Focus, which has been looking more at her family ties and how they led to her resignation. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby. The music is by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producers are Zoe Hitch and Nicole Jackson.
This is The Guardian.
Thank you. Du träumst davon, dem Alltag zu entfliehen oder die Welt zu bereisen? Das bedeutet wahrscheinlich, dass du dir ein unabhängiges Leben wünschst. Investieren für deine Zukunft kann dir dabei helfen. Mit iShares ETFs kann jeder anfangen, kleine, regelmäßige Beträge zu investieren. Und das schon ab einem Euro. So kannst du deine Zukunftsziele erreichen, ohne einen Berg von Papierkram zu bewältigen. Mehr Zeit zum Träumen. Finde iShares bei deinem Broker oder deiner Bank und fange noch heute an, mit ETFs zu sparen. Kapitalanlagerisiko. Marketinginformation.